nonprofit, if they're being paid, usually they are trapped in a dynamic, whether or not they want to be. While combining a job with organizing to challenge the system sounds tempting and full of potential, it's overwhelmingly not possible. There are two fundamentally incompatible aims. And on that note, this has been Air Cascadia for Monday, September 22nd, 2014. Kate Welch engineered the show today for us. Thanks so much, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO-AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Two years ago, Portland lost a musical and cultural icon with the passing of Ghanaian master drummer, bandleader, and teacher Obo Adi. His contribution to the raising of local knowledge and appreciation of African music in general, and Ghanaian music in particular, and his tireless work with local youth cannot be overstated. As part of our fall membership drive, KABU is proud to present a celebration and retrospective of Obo's work on Thursday, October 2nd, from 1 until 4 p.m. Musical offerings, remembrances, and interviews will be part of this important figure's legacy. Join Andy Hosh and DJ Charlie and others at 1 p.m. on Thursday, October 2nd. The preceding hour, from noon until 1 p.m., will be filled with Ghanaian music as part of DJ Charlie's regular World Beat Connection time slot. See you then.
And this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. We've been covering oil trains for a while on Locus Focus, but until recently, most news outlets carried few, if any, stories about what has now grown into a major concern. Across the United States and Canada, worry about the danger of these barely regulated trains carrying potentially explosive cargoes of Bakken crude oil has garnered increasing attention in the mainstream media. Meanwhile, more and more oil trains are passing through communities throughout North America, particularly in the Northwest. This morning, we are joined again by Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, who early on raised alarms about the dangers and numbers of trains passing through our communities. Eric will give us an update on the proposed federal rules on tank car and oil train operations and other oil train-related developments. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for coming back on the show, Barbara. It's good to be on.
You're kind of breaking up there. Can you try that again?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me back on the show. How's that sound now?
It's sounding still breaking up a little bit, but we'll see how it goes.
Okay, yikes.
Okay, yeah, we've been having a little bit of problem with our phones the last couple of weeks, so maybe we're just going to pray and everything will work fine today.
I hope so.
I don't remember, it was several months ago that we talked, but it seemed like the last time that we talked about oil trains, there was very little in the news about them. It was shortly after the big explosion in Quebec about 14 months ago. But that engendered a lot of concern, and then it disappeared again. But all of a sudden, in the last few months, I've been seeing reports in newspapers across the country, a lot of concern about oil trains going through individual communities, the fact that they are not being regulated, they're not being monitored at all. In fact, people don't even know, the right authorities don't even know what kind of shipments are going through on these trains. I'm wondering if you feel like there is better coverage of the story now, and if that's having any impact on changing regulations.
Well, there are a lot of questions in there. Let me just sort of start from the beginning. So, 14 months ago, an oil train traveling to a small town in Quebec derailed and it killed 47 people when it exploded because of it. Basically, was carrying a very combustible type of fuel. A very well-known sort of tank car that we've been unsafe for years and years and years. Since that time, we've actually had four additional catastrophic explosions of oil trains. Thank goodness none of them killed anybody, but one of them in particular in Lynchburg, Virginia, derailed and exploded right outside of downtown. It could easily have killed dozens, if not hundreds, of people. As a result of those events, which have been, you know, nothing short of horrifying, if you were to go online and sort of, you know, look for YouTube videos of oil train explosion in Lynchburg or in North Dakota, you just see these towering, literally 300-foot tall fireballs.
We actually have photographs of that on our website, both Lynchburg and Quebec, so people can get a sense of just the immensity of these explosions.
Yeah, the scale of the destruction is actually a little bit hard to describe, and it's easy to sound to be skeptical of it until you look at the photos or watch a video of it, because it's really quite something. There are folks, everyone from sort of first responders like firefighters to environmental advocates, who have been saying, look, at minimum, we need to know how many of these oil trains are there, and where are they going? Are they rolling through urban areas, rural areas? And what are our response plans to them? I mean, to me, that seems like a completely non-controversial thing to ask for. And yet, for the industry, it was extremely controversial. And that information has been pried out at great pains and only partially and only in some places. And so even at this late date, we still, in the Northwest, we actually have a fairly good sense about oil train numbers, not so elsewhere in the country. And then, you know, of course, in addition to that, we don't just want to know where the traveling bombs are headed. We'd like to either prevent them from running at all, or at minimum, make sure that they're transporting their goods safely through towns. There's a long version of the story, but the short version is that the federal government is right now in a rulemaking process. They've issued draft rules. There are 8 days left for public comment, we see some slightly increased safety standards for certain kinds of oil trains phasing in 3 years from now. So a big slow clap for the federal government, basically offering some very weak sauce to address a very serious problem.
Well, I want to go back to the fact that it's so hard to pry out from the railroad companies and, I guess, the people who are shipping this highly toxic substance. Why is it so hard to pry out the information about what is on these trains? Isn't it like federal law that we need to know, the public has the right to know what is on any kinds of trains or trucks going through its community?
Surprisingly not. In fact, there's very little information that's typically revealed about the transport of hazardous cargoes, especially when it's transported by rail.
Actually, you know what, Eric? I think we're going to try. We need to try to get you another connection, because this is really breaking out a lot.
I'm sorry about that, Barbara. Do you want to try calling me back on this line, or should I? What's the right way?
Yeah, we'll call you back on this line in right now, actually, and I will babble on until we get Eric back on. We're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who's the policy director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, and he's somebody that I have spent more time talking about oil trains with than probably anybody else, and he's been researching. He's been researching the number and cargoes of oil trains that are going through the Pacific Northwest for quite a while, and has written quite a few articles on the Sightline website, which is a place I highly recommend going for all kinds of information about environmental and social issues in the Pacific Northwest. And their website is sightline.org. And so Eric has been tracking the trains that are going up and down the I-5 corridor and along the Columbia River Gorge, and raising a lot of alarms about what this cargo is. So, Eric, we have you back. Let's see if it sounds a little bit better now.
Yeah, that sound now?
It's still not good, but I guess we're just going to have to figure out some way to live with it.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I've got a cell phone number as well. I can send
Well, let's try a little bit longer with this, and if this doesn't work, then we'll try the cell phone. But that's fraught with problems as well. So you were saying that it isn't really our business what's on what's carried on trains that is hazardous cargo?
There's very little information that's revealed to the public about that. So trains have for years transported corpses.
Hey, we just lost the thing that you just said. They've been transported what?
Chlorine, small quantities of propane, and other fuels like that. We're not typically known very much about those. That hasn't really been a huge problem until we saw a big increase in ethanol and shale oil-bearing trains moving through communities, and we've had some very catastrophic derailments. So typically speaking, the railroads do not reveal that information, and even under threat of litigation, we won't reveal information.
Again, you're really breaking up a lot. I think we need to get the cell phone.
Okay, I'm going to send it to you right now.
Actually, why don't you give me your cell phone number? We'll have a little bit of process over the air. Kate, can you take the cell phone number down, and then we're going to give you a call back on the cell phone. So what is your number, Eric? So in the meantime, while we're trying to get Eric on a clean line, again, I'll give a little bit more background. We're talking this morning about the oil trains that go through our communities and are rapidly increasing in numbers throughout the United States. And kind of a little bit of background that Eric touched on at the beginning of the show is that there was a really massive catastrophic explosion in Quebec in the summer of 2013, in July. It killed 47 people. It completely demolished, blew up, incinerated the downtown of the small resort town on the lake, very close to the main Quebec border, and woke up, I guess, the world to the dangers of oil trains. And these, it was not the first time that an oil train had exploded, but it was the first time it had exploded in a populated area and did so much damage and caused so much death. Since then, there have been, I guess, three more major explosions, though none of them were in populated areas. And we have Eric back. So, hello, Eric, are you back with us now?
I'm back again. Like, how does this sound?
It's at least, it sounds like a cell phone, but at least, you know, we can hear every word you're saying.
Okay,
so now I'll let you take over from what I was saying. So back to the fact that you were saying that we had we're transporting chlorine on cars for a long time, on railroad cars, and that was not as much of a concern as what they're transporting now. Is that what you were saying?
Right. So we've seen basically an enormous increase in just the sheer quantities of hazardous substance moving. The railroads have carried hazardous cargoes, and they've done it reasonably safely for a bunch of years. But when you start seeing, 120 car oil trains moving, when they're carrying a particularly volatile kind of oil, that becomes a big problem. And railroads have actually taken the position that that they are protected. They don't have to tell the public about the hazardous cargoes because of terrorism threats. And so they have taken this very peculiar line where it's okay for them to move a manifestly explosive cargo through a major downtown, and it's got a little placard on the side that identifies what the content is, but then they won't reveal any information to the public about it out of threat of terrorism, which I find to be a sort of curious and backwards way of thinking about the whole thing.
It does seem that they are the terrorists themselves, particularly if you're in a small community in Quebec last summer.
Well, sure, and there were several other near misses that really could have been serious. And right now, of course, there are loaded oil trains rolling through downtown Portland and downtown Seattle and all kinds of places across the rest of the country. And I think it's reasonable to believe that it's only a matter of time until something else awful happens.
Well, actually, I was on my way up to interview you last winter, and it was the first time I'd been up the I-5 corridor through Washington in probably about a year. And I was thinking about oil trains as I was driving up, and I take a look over my right shoulder, and there's an oil train. Right, it was right around Chehalis. And I noticed I went up to Vancouver a bunch of times after that, and so I was on this road frequently, and every time I was on the road, there was the oil train. So it made me think this is not just a coincidence that when I drive up I-5, there's an oil train. Obviously, they're coming up every day. And are they with that much frequency?
They are moving up every day. In fact, there are several moving a day, and they're coming in basically through Spokane, heading down to the gorge. Some of them split off, head through Portland out to Portner, Kroskinai, and then many others kind of turn right at Vancouver, Washington, and travel north to the refineries on Puget Sound. So we're seeing, you know, several a day through downtown Seattle, and Vancouver, Washington is seeing a bit more than that. So yeah, this is it's not surprising, and I've seen them too on that same drive along the I-4 corridor. And yeah, in fact, you know, half the time you'll see one parked down on the Seattle waterfront, which doesn't seem like a terribly safe place to leave an oil train.
Yeah. Well, considering what happened in Lac-Mégantic, this does seem to be quite... Of course, now I guess they're not leaving them with the brakes locked and the engineer in a hotel room sleeping. They've stopped doing that, I'm taking it.
Sure. But it seems to me that if the railroads really were concerned about the threat of terrorism, you wouldn't leave it parked right next to a very densely populated urban area with placards on it identifying what's in it. Because, you know, if there really is a risk of somebody doing something awful, that's just, you know, it's an egregious lack of security.
Well, there was also, wasn't there a train that derailed in Seattle not that long ago? And it wasn't a full, it didn't have full cargo, but it seemed to be kind of a wake-up call about what could happen.
It was quite scary. So there was an oil train moving between the rail yards. There's one rail yard south of downtown and another rail yard just north of downtown. And they were moving an oil train, a loaded oil train, between those two in the early morning hours. It was 3 a.m, I think. And it actually derailed. And two of the oil cars tipped over and fell off the tracks. And if, I don't know if the audience is familiar with the geography of Seattle, but it's happened under the Magnolia Bridge. So you're kind of right between the Queen Anne and Magnolia neighborhoods, just north of downtown. Nothing happened. None of it spilled. It didn't explode. It was moving at about 5 miles an hour, we think, when it happened. But had that train exploded in that location, the property damage and potential loss of life would have been enormous. So this isn't a hypothetical sort of thing. And these trains in general, although, you know, the railroads, again, do a pretty good job of moving cargo safely. There's going to be a small number of trains that derail, and if they're carrying a hazardous substance in an unsafe container, the risks are very, very high.
Now, I'm kind of curious why the train in Seattle didn't explode, considering that it seems that when these trains carrying the Bakken oil derail, that they tend to explode. So was there a reason, an understanding of what went right this time in Seattle so that it didn't turn into a catastrophe?
Well, so federal safety investigators are still in the process of sort of examining and evaluating all of the things that happened in those explosions. In Seattle, you know, we think that one feature was that it was traveling very, very slowly. And so when it derailed, it just sort of tipped over onto its side. At a higher speeds, you know, if you even, so let's say Lynchburg, Virginia, which was a pretty shocking one, that train was traveling, I think, at 24 miles an hour. And what can happen at those speeds is that there are valves on the bottom. Sometimes there are hatches on the top. Anything that could shear off, or if there's enough sort of dynamic force, you could have one end of a rail car puncturing another end of a rail car. And so anything like that happens, which typically would require a little bit more force, could then unleash the liquid fuel inside. And if that, is ignited by a spark or something, then there's a real problem. You know, there are also, of course, several different designs of these tank cars, some of which are very unsafe and some of which are only a little bit unsafe or partially unsafe.
Were the cars in the Seattle derailment, were those the DOT 111s, or which are the infamous ones?
They were not. Yeah, they were a newer kind of tank car called the CPC 1232, so the 1232s, and those are safer than the legacy Dot 111s. But they're not by any means immune to explosion. In fact, the derailment I keep mentioning in Lynchburg, Virginia, happened with that exact same kind of tank car, the CPC 1232.
And then the derailment in Quebec, their train was going a lot faster. Isn't that true? It was a runaway train, basically.
It was. It had been parked, and then it slipped its brakes and rolled down into town. And when it derailed, I can't remember the speed that train was traveling, but it was, I think, going reasonably fast when it derailed. But, you know, keep in mind, of course, that, you know, loaded oil trains are moving at speed through communities all across the Northwest right now. Certainly if you live on the Columbia Gorge or in eastern Washington, which is kind of the main route for many of those trains. I mean, there are trains probably, I would guess off the top of my head, at least 45 miles an hour through town, maybe faster. And that would be real concerning in the event of a derailment.
So let's talk about some of the regulations that are that are being proposed, and let's compare what's going on in the United States with what's going on in Canada in terms of regulating these trains.
Yeah, that's a great question to queue up, because your Canadian regulators have also been very interested in this question. And I wrote an analysis recently basically comparing what the Canadian regulators have done to what U.S. regulators have proposed. And on almost every score, the Canadians have moved faster and more aggressively. And I don't want that to be interpreted as me applauding what the Canadian regulators have done, because I think what they've done has been egregiously too slow, hard to enforce, and sort of difficult to evaluate. But that said, it's a whole step or two or three better than what we've seen in the United States. And I realize that that's sort of a generic sweeping assessment, but if folks, I'll post this up on the blog later today with some other stuff, if folks want to check out kind of a line-by-line look at the details of these regulatory approaches.
So what do we have to be concerned about? What is not being addressed by U.S. and or Canadian regulations?
So I would say let me highlight two or three of the biggest problems. There are several different kinds of tank cars. The most dangerous is what we call the Legacy .111. That's an old sort of Pepsi can shaped tank car that's been likened to a Ford Pinto, meaning that when it gets in a wreck, it tends to explode. We've got several thousand of those still riding the rails, still carrying oil in the United States. The U.S. federal regulations, and we know that they explode. They've exploded with ethanol. They've exploded with shale oil. We've known this for 20 years that they're dangerous. Now, after five catastrophic oil train explosions, the U.S. government is proposing a three-year phase-out for those cars, or retrofit, 3 years from now. While we're looking forward to oil train increases, we've seen oil train increases of 50 or 60 times over previous numbers. Up now, it could easily go up to 100 times. So that's number one. Those will still be on the rails for another 3 years, potentially. Then, if they're not in what are called unit trains, that is, if they're just a few of them, like fewer than 20 on a train, they'll still be allowed after 3 years.
So just to back up a little bit, so unit trains are trains that are totally one cargo. In this case, they're all carrying oil.
That's right.
And how long are they usually? How many cars?
They are usually 100 to 120 cars. So when you see a coal or an oil train, those are typically unit trains. They're typically a mile or so long, usually a little bit longer than a mile. And they're carrying one kind of cargo. And they always, and a unit train is distinctive because it takes cargo from one site to one destination. So they're usually routed a bit faster because they're not sort of stopping to add or pick up or drop off cars.
So with these concerns, I mean, are the new cars, I think actually the trains that I've seen between Portland and Seattle, they look a little bit more streamlined, and they don't look like Pepsi cans. So I'm assuming that they're slightly newer trains, but are there concerns with the newer trains as well?
Well, to be honest with you, we don't exactly know where these legacy .111s are moving. And keep in mind that even the newer tank cars are they still have known safety flaws. But we don't really know where those older cars are moving or whether how they're mixed in with the newer cars. So it could be that you might look at something and say, oh, that looks like a sort of a newer model, or it looks like a new tank car. It's entirely possible. It's also entirely possible that there are a few of the really dangerous ones mixed in there. Later in the day, there'd be another train that would look different. And one sort of additional thing to add is that we've got a big problem right now with just sort of basic knowledge about this stuff. And to me, given where we are at this point in time, I think it really says something about the state of the oil industry that they're not willing to reveal just kind of basic information about what they're loading into these tank cars and what kind of tank cars they're loading them into and where they're headed. So that's I think super frustrating, and super frustrating that the federal government is not going to require them to do that.
Well, you also talk about in one of your articles that's posted on your blog that there's an issue with the railroad companies and the oil companies being underinsured for shipping these really hazardous cargoes. I want to talk a bit about that and maybe look at your comparison with the kind of insurance that the government guarantees for nuclear power plants.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think this is maybe the single biggest issue that we're looking at right now. So you would think that if you're going to run a train full of an explosive oil, you would have to carry some reasonable amount of insurance on it. But you would be wrong if you thought that, because you don't have to. The train that it derailed and killed 47 people in Quebec was carrying about $25 million in insurance. $25 million. The rebuilding costs for that town are estimated at $2.7 billion right now. Loss of life and property would be on top of that. Oil spill remediation and cleanup would be on top of that. So you could be up in the $3 to $4 billion range for a railroad carrying $25 million in insurance. So needless to say, that railroad went out of business immediately and went bankrupt. New York investment firm has sort of picked up the bones of what remains of that short line railroad. But this is a real problem, because right now we have trains running through big cities that do not have anywhere near the level of insurance they would need for an explosion. If you had an explosion in downtown Portland, for example, you can bet that the cost would be much, much higher than in a small town in Quebec. And now BNSF and Union Pacific, the big railroads, carry much higher levels of insurance, but still nothing even approaching the level that they would need to pay for the damage. So then you're in a really peculiar situation where, they're running a dangerous cargo. They won't tell us anything about it. We know they're not insured for it. And the federal government is not going to require them to cover. We don't think it's not going to require them to carry insurance. The Canadians have moved a little bit faster on that score, but probably not nearly fast enough.
So what's going to happen? I mean, this sounds like we're just really just – it sort of reminds me of what we're doing in the Middle East right now, between, rushing to war in the Middle East or, like, rushing to blow up our oil trains here in the United States. It seems like we are rushing ahead without any real grappling with the consequences.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like I'm the sort of radio guest who's just ranting and frustrated on the air right now. But that's
I want positive solutions, Eric. I want to know what to do.
Yeah, well, the truth is we need a big regulatory fix for this, and it's not going to come from the federal agencies. Right now, the PHMSA, which is an acronym for the sort of Pipeline and Hazardous Substance Agency, and the U.S. Department of Transportation, are really not moving anywhere near aggressively enough on this. We're going to need a legislative remedy. We're going to need a remedy from Congress. And so on some, I personally am very frustrated with what we've seen from the federal agencies. And so I think until we have, action from Congress that actually says, look, you have to carry insurance. If you're going to move, what amounts to a bomb through a neighborhood, you at least have to be insured for that. That I think is our best hope. What's interesting about that, though, is that they probably can't get private insurance sufficient to the risk. So, right now, it is, I think, fairly well known, and even the railroads have admitted that they can't go out of the private insurance market, and you can't buy a sort of an oil train policy. And even if you could, it would be so expensive that it would probably make it uneconomical for them to run those trains. So, to me, that means, hey, that's a pretty clear signal from the private market, from the marketplace, that these things are too dangerous. They're so dangerous that you can't get insurance for them. Maybe we shouldn't be running in them. And that's not, that's not sort of the language of a firefighter concerned about public safety, who are also opposed to oil trains right now. That's not the language of sort of environmental activists worried about climate change. That's simply the private capital market saying, this is too risky for us to provide insurance for. So to me, I think honing in on this problem of drastic underinsurance is very, very useful on a bunch of fronts.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking with Eric DePlace, who is the director policy director for Sightline Institute. He's based in Seattle, and we're talking about the dangers of oil trains here on Locus Focus. Well, what you just said, Eric, gets me to thinking about this workshop I was sitting in at the Society for Environmental Journalists conference a couple weeks ago, called "It Was Oil Trains, Pipelines, Blah Blah, Running Through Your Backyard," and I went to that workshop with a great deal of interest, and I was really kind of discouraged by the talk about basically Well, there was an understanding that oil trains are dangerous, but that we aren't going to get enough pipelines, and the pipelines are safer, but they have some problems. But since they're so hard to get permitted, we're back to oil trains. And then there was somebody, and I don't remember which environmental group she was from. It might have been the Environmental Defense Fund, but basically somewhere there was a understanding she was alluding to that we really need to pull back on both of our, in our exploration of and extraction of oil from the earth, and also in putting so much cargo in dangerous situations like oil trains. But I didn't hear anybody really talking about what do we do as an alternative to this. So do you have a sense that the status quo is going to be more and more oil trains and there's nothing we can do to stop them?
Well, that's a great question on a bunch of fronts. So I share the view that we need to stop extracting and processing this stuff and burning it. It's simply way too dangerous to the climate and to other for other environmental reasons. The difficulty right now is that we're actually sort of going the opposite direction. We are making additional private and public investments in oil infrastructure, and we're doing that across the country. So we need to stop making those investments in oil trains and tank cars, in loading and unloading facilities, and all that stuff. I think that's actually a means to an end or a means to the end of transitioning away from fossil fuels. I think you're right to suggest that the sort of quote-unquote status quo, or you know, probably the most likely forward-looking scenario, is that we see more and more oil trains. But I don't think we have to accept that as sort of the new reality. You know, there are all kinds of things that we could do if we had a little bit more sort of active legislative approach to this that could prevent those oil trains from running. And that would have the effect of, you know, preventing further extraction of shale oil.
Well, I see it on a whole bunch of different fronts. There were close to 400,000 people who marched in New York City yesterday, part of the People's Climate March. And here in Portland, I guess there were several thousand people. I was one of them down in Waterfront Park, where actually somebody had a very interesting bicycle-driven float of an oil train bomb, as they described it. And it looked like that Pepsi can you're describing, all, you know, shrouded in black. And I wonder if those numbers of people in the streets, which got ignored largely by the mainstream media, the only media that I saw that covered it decently was the New York Times, actually, and Al Jazeera. But do you get the feeling that that kind of public upswell may have at least some effect on legislative action, that this could get the Congress to try to start putting some kinds of laws in effect that would protect our communities?
Yeah, I hope that's right. I mean, I don't think anybody looks at Congress right now and thinks that we've got a super effective legislative branch of government. So I don't want to sort of sound too Pollyanna about the prospects for near-term legislation. You know, that being said, I mean, to me, you know, trying to be as objective as possible, the oil train sort of issue right now is so crazy that I can't imagine that at some point we're not going to end up with a more robust legislative or regulatory approach where at least we have to know about where they are, at least we have to insure them, which might put them off the tracks, and at least we have some other safeguards. Now, I don't know if that's really how it's going to play out, but I do think with the climate march you mentioned in New York, and you know, my sense is that although the mainstream media has been pretty good at ignoring or downplaying the climate advocacy movement. We have like 400,000 people in New York yesterday. The groundswell of support for climate action, the groundswell of movement to get away from fossil fuels is actually pretty huge. And I have to believe that at some point there's going to be a tipping point or a sort of a phase shift in which what seems now like a marginal concern, as portrayed in the mainstream media, becomes sort of an obvious thing we have to do. How and when that happens, I don't have a guess, but I guess that's my belief.
Actually, I read an article to that effect this morning online. I think Climate Wire, or it was one as an environmental website blog, and that was, they're saying that the mainstream media can only ignore this issue for so long, and But if there's enough people on the street, it might actually have an impact on getting the attention. But and that's what happened with the Vietnam War. I mean, they ignored us too. I mean, I was following the coverage of the New York March yesterday before I went down to the Portland March, and they were saying tens of thousands of people, and there was no numbers until late afternoon when they came up with a figure. It was the organizers came up with a figure of 310,000, upped it to 400,000. The police were saying 70,000 or something. And it reminded me of the first march I went to against the Vietnam War back in 1967 in Washington, D.C. And got there and never seen so many people in my life. The organizers said 250,000. New York Times said the next day 25,000. It was a big lesson for me. And the fact that the New York Times does not always tell the truth. So it's again this thing of like them trying to downplay the numbers, but if you were in New York or if you saw the photographs, it was obviously a huge number of people. Does this start to permeate into consciousness of like, oh, that all those people are in the streets, this is maybe something I should be thinking about, maybe this is something I should be pressuring my representative about?
I think so, and I think it's the importance of activism, of rallies, of marches like that, of actually putting physical people in the streets in solidarity, it just can't be overstated. I mean, you can have all the people like me, policy directors at think tanks writing op-eds, but that is really pales in comparison to the moral force of people in the streets demanding change. So I think that's absolutely the sort of direction that we'll need to go. And I think it will have an effect over time. I think the Vietnam War analogy is probably an apt one, but ultimately, to the extent that our democracy is still kind of creaking along in any kind of functional way, it has to respond to that. And then I would add, on top of that, sort of the physical reality of climate change is starting to bite now. And the droughts in California, maybe one good example of that, or at least one preview of what's to come. There will be, I think it's fair to say, within the next few years, at least the next few decades, some pretty, harsh demonstrations of what the future could look like under a changed climate. And I have to believe that the physical reality coupled with social activism will begin to change things.
Well, it certainly affected people in the Marshall Islands. So when the rest of us are feeling the effects to the degree that the Marshall Islands are, I would imagine that we'll all be activists like the Marshall Islands citizens.
Right. But, South Florida, parts of New Jersey, drought scenarios, all kinds of climate impacts in all kinds of different places. I mean, the Marshall Islands is pretty depressing to consider, really. But I think South Florida is also pretty depressing.
I was at this conference. The conference was in New Orleans, and it was a lot of focus on the Southeast. And a woman from Broward County gave a presentation where she's showing these slides of this multi-million-dollar subdivision with these big McMansions, and the streets are full of seawater, up to like the just below the windows of this very expensive home, which has a for sale sign on it. And she said, this doesn't happen every day. So this house's ability to be sold will really depend on whether, it's flooding the day that this, the buyer comes to look at it. But it's not flooding because it was raining. The sun is out. It's because she said, the ground is like Swiss cheese and the seawater is just coming up from below. And it was, I knew that South Florida, is really threatened, as is southeastern Louisiana, and they'll be underwater possibly by mid or late of the century. However, to see those photographs and to see what this is going on right now was really chilling. And people in South Florida are getting organized. I think that very conservative forces in Broward County, actually Broward and Dade County, and the other one, Palm County, they're all combining, kind of regional government, forming regional government organizations to deal with this threat of sea level rise. So it's when it hits you, when it starts to bite you, it certainly seems to transcend politics.
Right. I think that's a great point. And, southern Louisiana is very interesting, in part because they're losing, the acreage of wetlands they're losing a day is like, I can't remember the figure.
It's a football field an hour.
Yeah, that's what it is, right.
Yeah.
Which is like hard to conceive of, actually. But that's a pretty credible estimate, I think. And What's interesting about Southern Louisiana is that it is so clearly paired up, the climate impacts, with fossil fuel industry, because there are so many places you can go around there where you see oil refinery flares, you see natural gas fracking fields. There are, you know, coal transport terminals on the lower Mississippi. And so what a great place that just crystallizes the whole destructive nature of the fossil economy and this, incredibly vibrant ecosystem that is literally disappearing in front of our eyes right now, with big consequences for human communities as well. So, you know, I really think, I'm glad you mentioned Louisiana, because it feels like in some ways that is the perfect encapsulation of the whole issue in one location.
Well, actually, it's interesting. I mean, I did a show on that last week with Mark Sleepstein, who's an environment reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. But I ran into people at the conference who are fighting coal trains in Louisiana, and they're modeling their movement after the Power Pass coal movement here in the Northwest. And it's very interesting to contrast the difference in fighting fossil fuel industry in Louisiana and up here, because up here it's seen as like from the outside. In Louisiana, they can't even talk about climate change. That's a term that's like really foreboding in a lot of communities, because people are so dependent on the fossil fuel industry for their livelihoods. So I guess I wanted to end the show today by talking a little bit about efforts to transform this area into another Southeast Louisiana with the proposed oil terminal that's being planned by the Port of Vancouver, Washington, for Vancouver, Washington. I'm wondering if you know what's happening with that development and how likely it is that that's going to happen.
Right. So for folks who may not know, there's an absolutely enormous oil train terminal plan for Vancouver, Washington, for the port there. 360,000 barrels per day would make it maybe the biggest in the country. I'm not sure, but it's got to be close. And that oil would then be transported onto barges or vessels that would head out to Pacific markets, maybe in California, maybe across the ocean. It's a huge proposal, potentially extremely destructive for the Columbia and for the local community. I have to say, when we first started paying attention to that particular project, I guess it was about a year and a half ago or so, I did not imagine that we would be at the point we are today, where Vancouver, Washington is rising up against that proposal in a huge way. The city council has voted unanimously to express their opposition to it. They've voted unanimously to enact a 60-day moratorium on any oil infrastructure in the town. And we're seeing residents, businesses, the whole nine yards come out swinging against that proposal. So I think, you know, in some ways, and Vancouver, Washington is, as most of your audience may know, it's not politically as liberal as Bellingham, say, where we've seen lots of anti-coal.
Or Portland, which is right across the river, for that matter.
Or Portland, right.
Where there's a lot of opposition also to this oil terminal.
Absolutely. So to me, though, it's actually sort of more encouraging that in a Clark County can go Democrat or Republican in any given election. But the scale of opposition has been absolutely overwhelming there. And so I think it's a real crystallization and a really positive note for what Northwest communities can do when confronted with proposals that would, as you say, basically turn them into Gulf Coast on the Pacific.
So hopefully if this oil terminal is stopped, it will at least not increase the number of oil trains going through the Northwest. However, if it's built, it seems like then we will start to become Southeast Louisiana.
Yeah, if that terminal is built, it will basically double the number of oil trains moving through the region. But if it's not built, I think it sends a real chilling effect through the industry, because it shows that these proposals do not have to be sort of swallowed. I think it will be the same thing that we're already seeing with the coal exports debate, where, you know, originally there were six coal export proposals, we're sort of down to two or maybe two and a half now. And that has sent shockwaves to the coal industry. When the Northwest does the same thing with oil train terminals, like especially that one at Vancouver, I think that's going to have ripple effects all the way back to the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota, where it will no longer be clear that you can just sort of build a terminal, ship the oil, and do whatever you want. I'd like to describe it as a thin green line standing between these big fossil fuel reserves and climate destruction.
And at this note, we are out of time, Eric, but I'm glad to find you ending on a positive note.
Well, thank you, Barbara.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
So we'll, let's talk again soon. I'd like to talk more about the Vancouver oil terminal and maybe get somebody locally who's from Vancouver who's fighting it and have you talk with them. So we can plan that sometime later on in the fall or early winter. So thanks a bunch. We are talking, and we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guests are Seth Darling and Douglas Sisterson, co-authors of How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening.
And it is 1 minute past 11 a.m. You do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up is Disability Awareness with host Grace Reed. She spotlights PHC Northwest Beyond Limitations. And then stay tuned at 11:30 for Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall, who will speak with Dr. Martin Donahue about some of the health and environmental consequences associated with growing genetically modified crops.